Thank you, Laura, for inviting me here. This has been a long time coming, and I'm delighted to be here, and thank you all for being here. This talk starts with the premise that mushrooms are very interesting, but people are even more interesting. And people that love mushrooms are the most interesting of all. I approach this subject from the point of view of history. I'm an archivist, and for a time after I got into the subject of mushrooms and mycology, I worked at the New York Botanical Garden, organizing the papers of mycologists and botanists throughout the 19th and 20th century. And I have to say, it was one of those kind of jobs where you're almost embarrassed to say you're getting paid for it. Almost. But four of the people that you'll see me talking about today, mycologists, I actually organized the papers of, and that includes Charles Horton Peck, William Alfonso Merle, Clark Rogerson, and Sam Resnich. So if archivists do anything different than perhaps all of you in your professional and personal endeavors, we certainly travel in time and we talk with the dead. And to hold the correspondence and reports and papers of a mycologist who has long since passed is something almost sacred in my opinion. It's a really very special endeavor. So today I'll talk about the enthusiasm that mushroom study generates. And I know we know that enthusiasm means a very strong and passionate interest in something, but it also means being possessed by a spirit or a god, and I think that will come out here too, because I'm touching on possibly the evangelical in mycology, and this is brought out by studying with people who study it. I also talk about the mushrooms that I do show you. You will see some photos of mushrooms this afternoon. And I think I mentioned at one point, I'll talk about the ascus of the ascomycetes, and that's what you see on the screen right now. There are several, this is a photomicrograph of Sam Resnich's, and it's a microphotograph of Scutellinia scutellata, a cup fungus, and you can see each one of those sacs has 8 spores, which is characteristic of an ascomycete. This talk is dedicated in loving memory to Gary Linkoff, my dear friend. This is a photograph that I took at the Telluride Mushroom Festival several years ago. And as Sam Resnich would have said, Gary is now walking the great galactic path that we all will walk individually one day. And Gary was fascinated with Thoreau, as I am. He used Facebook as a tool to launch Thoreau into the minds of many, many people. And perhaps the mycologists among us might think it odd that I would start with Thoreau as a mycologist, but I submit to you that the reading of Henry David Thoreau is enriching and essential, and Thoreau, above all people, perhaps until we get to John Cage, knew that there was something about looking at organisms of life in the woods that partook of the sacred and of silence, and I recommend you, many of us have read Walden, but I recommend you dip into his journals and see what he says about the perception of the natural world. It applies to us, and it applies to the endeavor of studying fungi. Now, Charles Horton Peck was an early enthusiast. Perhaps you might not think of it in those terms because he was a sober Presbyterian, but he was a New York State botanist for about 3 decades, more than 3 decades, from the late 1860s until 1912. He was the go-to person for mycological information from the post-Civil War era into the Great War of, which is now known as World War I. He produced reports every year of the state botanists naming flowers and mushrooms throughout New York State. Funny, he was really restricted to New York State. I suppose he loved New York State, and at that time, in the status of mycological knowledge, he knew that there was enough to study in New York State to satisfy him for a lifetime, and he did. He was the first to climb several of the peaks of the Adirondacks, and people from positions as teachers or engineers or social workers or just regular folks wrote to him regularly and religiously about identifying their mushrooms. So when I organized his papers at the New York State Museum, I had a correspondence that correlated to a herbarium collection in the New York State Museum of fungi that Hess had found throughout New York State and that he had named. He named over 1,200 species of mushrooms, and some of those names still hold up today. One that you see on the right panel is Agaricus subrufescens. That is the genus name, the species-specific epithet, and then Peck, the person who named it. That's how it's usually styled in botanical nomenclature. And this might have become the edible button mushroom of the ages, but it did not. For some reason, it was cultivated and appreciated for its good kind of almond flavor back at the turn of the century, but for some reason, it fell out of grace, and now instead we have Agaricus bisporus, which is a common button mushroom we know in grocery stores. But this was a popular edible back in Peck's day. Again, his contribution to mycology was enormous in the 19th century, and everyone referred to him as the person to go to. The next person was definitely an enthusiast. He said he was an enthusiast. He loved proselytizing about mushrooms. Charles Old Iron Guts McIlvaine. And John Cage's idea here that Charles McIlvaine we should treat with a little skepticism because he was a little too enthusiastic about mushrooms is certainly true. His book, 1,000 American Fungi, is serviceable today, if not the best guide, and certainly far out of date in terms of names. But it's something that was organized by Swarcolor and certainly does help us, and it helped a lot of people during the century. This is Charles McIlvaine on the left facing off against an adversary of his, Thomas Taylor. Actually, I would say Thomas Taylor, just briefly, was probably the other focus of interest and communication in the mycological world of, say, 1900. Peck in Albany and Taylor as the U.S. microscopist for the United States government were the people who published information about mushrooms, and people turned to them. Charles McIlvaine was an engineer, and he noticed huge profusions of lactarias growing in burnt-over areas in the mountains of West Virginia in the 1880s. Acres and acres of lactarias. And he said, this is food. Let me taste it. Let me try it out. And he did, and he became passionately interested in the fungi. So much so that he developed a mycological center in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Mycological Center, it's actually called, and he became well known for his tours on talking about edible mushrooms, and he tasted more than anything that we would want to taste. For instance, a known toxic mushroom like Boletus satanus. We would never recommend that for the table. He claimed it was toothsome and delicious. Now, I don't have a photograph of a person by the name of Count Achilles de Vecchi. So these two slides of Ammonite and Muscari will have to do. Briefly, Achilles de Vecchi was an Italian diplomat. He was the herald, he was the contact from Garibaldi to give Italian support to the Civil War. De Vecchi was the emissary from Garibaldi to Abraham Lincoln in the 1860s. He became active in Republican politics in the United States. He was a portly gentleman, very well known in Washington, D.C., and he asked some African-American market women who sold mushrooms in the K Street Market in Washington to deliver to him Ammonita caesarea, and what they did was deliver to him Ammonita muscaria. He ate a plateful one morning, went into convulsions, and died. This was in 1897. This made celebrated news in the press in Washington and in New York and throughout the East Coast, just at the time the mushroom clubs were forming in Boston, in Philadelphia, and in D.C. and New York. And it was a big deal. And it was reported that Thomas Taylor had made a mistake in misidentifying Ammonita muscaria as the edible Ammonita caesarea in these publications. Now you see the captions on these, both are labeled Ammonita muscaria. I searched far and wide for that mistake and I could not find it. But this was one of the stimuli to amateur mycology at the turn of the century. And I look everywhere for a photograph of Achilles sedacei, and I was unable to find it. So these two photographs will have to do. And also these photographs of the mushrooms that the African Americans were actually selling in an open air market in the United States. We don't see that so much today at all. Perhaps in Oregon, perhaps in the Northwest Coast. But in Europe, it's quite common to see wild mushrooms being sold out in open air markets. These four mushrooms, Agaricus campestris on the left, and below it, the Primus clematis, known as the shaggy mane, are two choice edibles that we know today. These two, by the way, I point out first because they're included in John Cage's mushroom book. The other two are Agaricus arvensis and a puffball, Calvatius iapiformis. So these were the four mushrooms that were being sold regularly. As far as I know, from the reports that I read, these women did not know any other mushrooms that were edible and good to sell but these, and they were sold religiously until Achilles sedacei came along and said, get me some Amanita caesarea. He died as a result. McIlvaine continued his proselytizing and was on the Chautauqua circuit in New York State, and he died, I believe, in 1909. He was also known by the moniker Tobe Hodge. That was his pseudonym. He wrote several nature stories and was interested in teaching boys and girls about nature. A legend of Polecat Hollow. Does everyone know what a polecat is? Polecat is a skunk. Yes, indeed. So that was Charles McIlvaine. He's kind of a touchstone in mycology. And so was this man, the naturalist in quotes. He styled himself the naturalist. William Alfonso Merle was the second professional mycologist, staff mycologist, on the staff of the New York Botanical Garden beginning in around 1904. He was at the New York Botanical Garden for several years. He was also a person who studied the agarics, the boletes, and the polypores, the macrofungi that we see right over here on the table today. He wasn't studying too much of microscopic fungi, although he did point out the proximate cause of chestnut blight, which started at the Bronx Zoo, just not too far away from where he worked at the New York Botanical Garden. Very tragic story with William Alfonso Merle. He founded the journal that we know today, Mycologia, and that was in 1904. And today, I don't think we could, unless you're a geneticist, couldn't even make sense of the articles in Mycologia, because it's all about DNA analysis. But amateurs read this journal back then, and they were accompanied by beautiful watercolor illustrations by Mary Eaton, which you see here, Blackterius and Rushabaugh. Merle had a penchant for studying the herbaria in European collections, and went there once, I believe in 1918, 1919, developed a polycystic kidney condition and was hospitalized literally for months in a small town in southern France. Today, if that happened to any one of us and we wanted to save our job, we would call our supervisor or manager and say, I'm ill. He had no way of getting in touch with Nathaniel Lord Britton, the director of the New York Botanical Garden, and they basically cast him off as dead. And then he showed up many, many months later. He got into some difficulties with Nathaniel Lord Britton's wife, Elizabeth Gertrude Britton, who was known to be rather dictatorial. And in the end, he was dismissed from his job after 20 years as not only staff mycologist at the New York Botanical Garden, but he was second in command to Britton at one time. He was down and out. He had a Thoreauvian impulse and built himself a cabin in the woods near Stanton, Virginia. He was depressed. He had a divorce. And he was found several years later in 1927 playing the piano at the Tin Can Tourist Camp in Gainesville, Florida, by a mycologist, George Weber, there. And he rejoined the ranks of the mycologist and worked semi-professionally at the University of Florida in Gainesville for another 30 years. So his really tragic story, his life is bifurcated by these two chapters in his life. But in the meantime, around 1914, 1915, he developed an amateur mycological society in Yama Farms in the Adirondacks. And he invited people such as the DuPonts, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, Rabindranath Tagore, John Burroughs. All of these people were known to William Burroughs, and he was certainly a proselytizer of the spirit of the fungi to all of these very well-known people in American society. But there was another person who is very, very little known, and that's Howard Atwood Kelly. Howard Atwood Kelly appears on the left in this famous painting by John Singer Sargent. These are the big four of the Johns Hopkins Medical School in the early part of the 20th century. Kelly was a gynecologist. He wrote the most used text in operative and surgical gynecology at the time. And he was also an evangelical Christian. He wore on his lapel a button with a question mark on it to elicit from people, well, what's the question? And when he would get that response from them, people seeing his button, what's the question? He would say, well, what do you think of Jesus? And that actually turned into something that he applied to all of his natural history pursuits, including mushrooms. He was an amateur herpetologist. He was very well known in social circles in Baltimore, Maryland. He had a running fight with the journalist H.L. Mencken in the press about science and religion. And H.L. Mencken pilloried him mercilessly about the discrepancy between, here is a scientific man that has committed so much of his life toward medical knowledge, and yet he was an evangelical Christian, and Howard Mencken said this. Here's a kind of spoof caricature of Howard Atwood Kelly by Mencken. Before cockcrow in the morning, he has got out of bed, held a song and praise service, read two or three chapters in his Greek Old Testament, sung a couple of hymns, cut off six or eight legs, pulled out a pint of tonsils and eyeballs, relieved a dozen patients of their appendices, filled the gallstone keg in the corner, pronounced the benediction, washed up, filled his pockets with tracks, got into a high-speed automobile with the Reverend W.W. Davis, and started off at 50 miles an hour to raid a gambling house and close the red light district in Emery Grove, Maryland. This went on and on for years. And yet they saw each other socially, and yet they were at odds with each other in the Baltimore press. Here is a picture of Howard Atwood Kelly with a shell. I wish it was a mushroom, but it is not. And the reason I heard of Howard Atwood Kelly in the first place was a collection that I organized at the New York Botanical Garden of the English translation of a very famous mycological text, Selecta Fungorum Parpologia, by Louis René and Charles Tulane. And they, without going into this very deeply, they were the first people to explain pleomorphism in the fungi, that there could be a sexual and asexual state in some fungi. But the reason this led me to Kelly were three letters in that collection that Kelly had written underwriting this entire project of translation, this three-volume magisterial work. And here are the kinds of quotations in the preface from the Tulane's magnum opus. They said, of all the plants which have ever flourished upon the footstool of God, fungi lead the most humble life. Yet one should not rashly despise fungi and that which relates to them. For they who are not created without reason, nor the will of the botanist who deserves himself to their study, repent of so doing. We will endeavor to bring forth from even the very smallest of his creature the praise of him by whom all things were made, who is before all and in whom all things consist, unto whom, immortal, invisible, the only God, be honor and glory forever and ever. This was the Tulane's preface, and this was something that Kelly loved. It matched his mindset and matched his religious fervor, and he applied that to actually studying the fungi. So he was very, very willing to underwrite this project. And I will leave you to read this last quotation. Fungi are daily evidence that life arises from death, so with the will and help of God, death brings forth life to the very end of time. Kelly loved it, and he amassed a collection of mycological literature that was enormous, donated to the University of Michigan. He actually had the mycological artist Louis Krieger under his employ on retainer for a 10-year period, just in order to describe a fungi. And you can see that this tradition of understanding the fungi in terms of religious perspective has other manifestations as well. For instance, Miles Joseph Barclay, a very famous English clergyman and mycologist, in a situation here that involves the elevation of the host in the Christian Mass. But if you think that is a cartoon illustration of transubstantiation and transformation, this is the real transformation that transformed amateur mycology and professional mycology at mid-century. And this was the encounter of Robert Gordon Wasson with the Mazatec healer Maria Sabina on one of his several junkets to Oaxaca, Mexico in the middle of the 1950s. Robert Gordon Wasson, who you see on the left, was a very wealthy banker. He worked for J.P. Morgan and Company. He married a Russian by the name of Valentina, Valentina Wasson and Robert Gordon Wasson were quite a pair in the 1950s. They started out by writing a cookbook. It became a magisterial study, Mushrooms, Russia, and History, published in 1957. Was it about mushrooms, Russia, and history? Not much. There was one chapter on Russia, and most of the rest of it was devoted to an etymological study of mushroom names and describing his encounter in Oaxaca with this shamanist who used psilocybe mushrooms, like psilocybe cyrulescens, which Merle actually had found in Alabama in 1927 and named it. This is a Merle-named mushroom. But this was life-changing and really history-changing in terms of what happened next. Because along with Mushrooms, Russia, and History, Wasson published an article in search of the magic mushrooms, the first time that word was used in the press anywhere, in Life magazine, May of 1957, and that caught the attention of the world. It certainly caught the attention of a growing counterculture in the 1960s that flocked to Oaxaca to see if they could also partake of the spirit of this particular mushroom, which is the hallucinogenic fungus. So, this is Robert Gordon Wasson in Oaxaca with friends. The date is 1958. Searching through a group of psilocybes. If these were all indeed psilocybe, there would be enough there to have one grand party for the whole bulk of us here this afternoon. Perhaps the whole town. But Wasson himself was not a professional mycologist. He was an amateur. I mean, he was a banker. He started out studying this on his own for a cookbook, and here's where it led him. He engaged the French mycologist, Roger M., to do illustrations, and they collaborated on a book, The Hallucinogenic Mushrooms of Mexico, which I don't believe was ever translated into English. It's a book that was translated into, it was originally in French. And this really changed how people came to understand mushrooms, because it ushered in the entire realm of the psychedelic era of the counterculture of the 1960s. He preferred to use the term ethnogen, entheogen, which means man manifesting the god within instead of psychedelic. He also claimed to be the originator of ethnomycology, and there's some substance to that. And he also claimed that there was a difference between mycophilia, loving mushrooms, and mycophobia, hating or fearing mushrooms, that was apparent in many, many cultures in various ways throughout history and throughout the world. So he went on to write many, many other books. But Maria Sabina was celebrated for her language, for her text, for her healing ritual that used these psilocybe mushrooms for soul flight in order to cure. And she was at the inspiration of the ethnopoetics movement, for instance, that Rick alluded to, that started in the 1960s with an understanding, with an anthropological and poetic understanding of the text and spoken words of many cultures throughout the world. So Maria Sabina was at the forefront of this, even though she was a humble Mazatec healer in Oaxaca. Not only that, but Wasson went on to write another huge book that you might use as a doorstop, but don't do that because it's a fascinating read, Soma, the Divine Mushroom of Immortality. I don't know if there's any other mushroom than Ammonite Mysteria that has such an enormous book scholarly research with appendices by other Hindu and Vedic scholars that created such a kind of a life-changing, cultural-changing moment in the history of all of this. You see on the left, you see Ammonite Mysteria and the book plate of Wasson's, and here is Ammonite Mysteria from Telluride. He also engaged Albert Hofmann, who not only synthesized LSD in the World War II era, but also psilocybin, the active ingredient in psilocybin mushrooms. This is a picture of ergot, which is an Ascomycetes fungus, which is at the basis of the synthesis of LSD. And that led to other proselytizers like Terence McKenna, who you may know. McKenna died in 2000, but he certainly lives on in many YouTube interviews talking about the riches of psilocybin. And of course, that has been continued in the Telluride Mushroom Festival. Here are Gary Lindhoff and Nanny Salzman. Nanny, by the way, also passed away within a month of Gary Lindhoff's demise. Here they are portraying two happy mad hatters with a prescription for happiness with Manny's endorsement of psilocybin right here. So that's at the Telluride Mushroom Festival. But let's get on to John Cage's position in all of this. And I think from our lessons this afternoon, you know that you have to be discriminating in order to understand your species. So there is nothing more than and the observation of mushrooms that improves the powers of observations. Many people think that John Cage's dalliance with mycology and mushrooms was just that. It was not. It was not a dalliance. It was not just a hobby. It was not something that seemed cute to the world that knew him from his position as a musician. He was. He discovered mushrooms as a matter of study in the early 1950s. And this is a short piece from Indeterminacy in which he discusses that passion. John Cage says, "In 1954, when I went to Europe, I no sooner arrived in Paris than I noticed that the city was covered with posters publicizing a mushroom exhibition that was being held in the Botanical Gardens. That was all I needed. Off I went. When I arrived, I found myself in a large room filled with many tables upon which were displayed many species of fungi. On the hour, from a large, centrally placed loudspeaker, a recorded lecture on the deadly poisonous Ammonitis was delivered. During this lecture, nobody in the room, in the hall, moved or spoke. Each person's attention was, so to speak, riveted to the information being given. A week later, I was in Cologne in Germany, attending a concert of electronic music. There was also an audience and a large loudspeaker. However, many in the audience were dozing off, and some were talking to their neighbors." That seems like an inconsequential innuendo in that short description. But what he was getting at was that mushrooms for him potentiated silence, which is really what he was trying to accomplish in music. Keys to unlock Cage. First of all, he redefined silence as non-intentional sound, and I won't go into that. It's a vast subject, and you can find that in many other areas elsewhere, in many books. His famous silent piece, 4 minutes and 33 seconds, was something that he said he played to himself all the time in his mind when he was out in the woods hunting for fungi. He also really found fungi through the spirit of Zen and talked about D.T. Suzuki and his lectures on Zen Buddhism and how that related to his reconnaissance of the fungi in the woods. He taught at the New School for Social Research, music and composition courses that later morphed into mycological courses and then field trips hunting fungi throughout the area here. He also was named as the Eastern Vice Chairman of the People for People Committee, which was an Eisenhower-based kind of pen pal network that was established by Harry Knighton, a machinist in Portsmouth, Ohio, that led to the creation of the North American Mycological Association. So John Cage was actually at the very beginning of what we know as NAMA, the North American Mycological Association. And not only that, he founded the New York Mycological Society in its third incarnation. There was a small group in New York in 1897. It passed. and then one in the early 1930s. It also went defunct, and then John Cage revived it. So that organization exists today, and that was thanks to Cage. And of course, he was into macrobiotics, and he appreciated eating fungi. He knew that you needed not chance operations, but very determinate observation in order to identify species that you could eat. This is a herbarium voucher from collections that are in the New York Botanical Garden Herbarium that were collected by John Cage and Lois Long at actually Slide Mountain, which is about 25 miles away from here across the Hudson River in the Catskills. And he actually has a small story in Indeterminacy about that, in which he thought that Lois Long and Christian Wolfe were going to be mifted him for searching for mushrooms at night and not finding what they wanted to find, and he found them back in the car looking at the Aurora Borealis. How beautiful. In 1972, he published The Mushroom Book, which was a collaboration with the mycologist Alexander Smith, along with Lois Long, who did the illustrations, and this is another illustration of Coprinus comatus, the shaggy mane in that book. And of course, he was known for his affiliation with D.T. Suzuki. This is a photo taken in Japan in 1962. And Suzuki wrote, "I am in nature, and nature is in me. Not mere participation in each other, but a fundamental identity between the two." And Cage said, in empty words, "The prepared piano, impressions I had from the work of artist friends, the study of Zen Buddhism, ramblings in the fields and forests looking for mushrooms, all led me to the enjoyment of things as they come, as they happen, rather than as they are possessed or kept and forced to be." So the whole world of mushrooms is something that potentiated silence, was integral to his other pursuits in art and in music. And since he has a smile, or at least a half smile on his face, I have to point out his good humor. This is a quote from a piece he wrote called, "Where Are We Eating and What Are We Eating?" He was on the road with the Merce Cunningham Dance Company, and he describes a scenario where they stopped for gas, and this is what John Cage wrote. "We had stopped for gas in Ohio. While the dancers were going to the toilets, buying snacks, and doing their exercises around the pumps, the station attendant asked me if we were a group of comedians. I said, no, we're from New York." This is Harry and Elsie Knighton, who were really the fundamental couple behind the creation of NAMA, and they engaged John Cage in this in the Northeast. Alexander Smith and Rolf Singer were very much a part of this story. Rolf Singer was a professional mycologist who wrote the magisterial Agaricales in Modern Taxonomy, and Smith worked at the University of Michigan. Here he is with Bunji Tagawa. Bunji Tagawa did the illustrations for Gary Linkoff's Audubon Guide, by the way. So he was a very well-known artist, and he did a famous cover for Scientific American in 1975 with an article by Walter Litton on poisonous mushrooms. And of course, he engaged with Clark Rogerson. I organized the Clark Rogerson papers at the New York Botanical Garden. There were three different collections, one in his lab, two in the basement of the garden's library, and one, a collection of rust fungi back in this crawl space in the bottom of the lab that was just a marvel to try to get out and organize. But I never knew Clark Rogerson. He was not only the historian of the Mycological Society of America and had several high-powered editorial positions. He was a scientific advisor to our club, the Connecticut Westchester Mycological Association. And I wrote to Clark after he left the garden and after I had organized his collection, saying that his collection had been properly preserved for the ages, and I received a letter of thanks for him, and that is something that I will always treasure in my own personal archive. But Clark was someone who had a close rapport with John Cage in the study of mushrooms throughout the 1970s and 1980s. Here is Gary Linkoff and John Cage at a celebration of the New York Mycological Society in the 1970s. I believe one of the two other people is the president of the NYMS at that time. Does anyone know who these two others are? I'm sorry that I don't.
Yeah, the guy, he started Revolution Books, that old bookstore.
Okay. I'm sorry that I don't know your identities.
Still
have it. Okay. Thank you. We'll talk about that later. And at the same event, John Cage with my mushroom mentor, Sylvia Stein. And I think you can see the look of admiration on Sylvia's face as she looked at John. That's how she always talked about him. I asked if she loved his music, and she said, absolutely not. I couldn't understand why someone would slap a big fish against the side of a piano and call it music. She was a traditionalist in music, but she really didn't get it. And I said, well, did you go to his concert? And she said, everyone. She loved him so much. This is Sam Ristich, Dr. Sam Ristich, who was a beloved mycologist in a post-retirement career of 30 years. He turned on the mycological communities in the Northeast. I mean, he was basically involved in the founding of COMA, the New Jersey Club, and the Maine Club. Gary once said that this was like the mycological equivalent of Moses coming down from the mountains. Two huge Ganoderma aplanatums that he's smiling with here. And Sam took about 25,000 photographs in his long career of mushrooms. And you would think that this would be an attractive photograph to him, an ensemble of beliefs. But what he was really interested in was something more like this. He was an entomologist by profession, and he looked at all of the relationships between other organisms, including insects and slugs that you see over these boletes. And here you see what we found today in the woods that Britt explained, Syzygides megalocarpus, which Sam fondly recalled as the troll doll fungus. Maggots in boletes, he loved a scenario like that. His PhD dissertation at Cornell University was on the seed corn maggot. Palobolus on a moose turd, a slug ragged the trail on an incipient polypore. Actually, there's an interesting quote that I found in my research on John Cage in mycology. I contacted the Palobolus Dance Company, because Palobolus is a psychomycete spongy, and I had heard that Cage had something to do with it. And Palobolus wrote back to me and said, no relationship between Cage and our company, though we did have lunch together once beside a swimming pool in southern France. Pierre Cardin was there as well. He ate a bad mussel and threw himself headlong into the pool. I just thought that was funny. Pierre Cardin throwing himself into a swimming pool. So Sam was also interested in anything and things like this. If you think that is a paintball splat against that stump, please leave the room. That is a slime ball. That is Fissurum polycephalum along with Pleurotus austriatus and a marvelous slime, if you imagine finding that today. And just like John Cage, Sam Ristich was interested in the artistic side of this all, and he promoted spore art, and his so-called disciples or seekers also entertained him with spore art in terms of the male. There's Sam and Sylvia, two of my mushroom mentors. And to end this, I will let you know that the paradigm is changing about mushroom enthusiasm. And this is a photograph of Paul Stamets, who has done so much to educate us about fungi, about psilocybe, about mycoremediation. And I will end by reading a quotation from Paul. He said, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. There is a convergence of science and spirituality. I believe that if you walk with respect for elders, respect for indigenous people, respect for the ecosystem, you walk in faith and with good intention, nature and science will reward you. And he said, I strongly believe that. And I think we believe that too. To conclude, I will say that I believe that history will show that it was John Cage, Gary Lindhoff, and Samuel Ristich together that really sparked the interest in mycology for the last half century or more in the Northeast and throughout the United States. And I'm very honored and proud to be a part of that history in organizing papers by some of these beloved men. In conclusion, I would like to thank all of these people, especially Laura Kuhn and Britt Bunyard and George Fascia for supporting my writing. I deeply appreciate that. And with that, I bid you adieu. Thank you.